big projector seemed to work for a minute, but doesn't seem to work for me right now. It's on, so I don't know what's wrong, but I'm going to have to do the smaller one off to the side. So last time we started talking about spring, and as I mentioned, spring is turning out to be very important. We will cover something called simple harmonic motion in this term, which is very important. Actually, we'll also do waves. So springs and the motion of, a spring undergoing simple harmonic motion is sort of the basis that you use to understand waves. And waves, mechanical waves, you're pretty familiar with in terms of, you know, water waves and stuff. Turns out that sound is waves, light is waves, etc. So you're going to have to do a good quantum mechanics is waves. So you're going to do a whole bunch of stuff with waves next semester. We'll certainly do some stuff this semester. And in the end, it all sort of boils down to springs. So although springs in and of themselves may not excite you, turns out to be very, very important. So last time we talked a little bit about springs, and basically the idea of a spring is, if I stretch it out, it pulls back. If I compress it, if this is its natural length, for example, which it isn't for the spring, but if it were, when I compress it, it's pushing back the other way. So there's a restoring force, and the degree to which it pushes, the force with which it pushes, is proportional to how much you compress or how much you stretch it. And it is symmetric. So if I stretch it out an inch this way, I get the same force pulling back as I do if I compress it this way. Now, in the real world, you've almost certainly done this in your childhood and playing with strings. If you stretch a string to a certain point, it no longer goes back. So we call that, I don't even remember what we call it, you go sort of going past its elastic limit, I guess some engineer might call it. So this kind of discussion of strings really is a pretty good approximation of reality if you're not pulling it out too far or compressing it too far. Just completely don't worry about that in this class. We're going to be worrying about strings in sort of their ideal range. And to a large extent, it's pretty true. But if you go into a career where you really need to use strings, talk to an engineer or something, because there probably are some non-linearities and things that you get. It may not give you exactly this behavior if you stretch it too far, compress it too much. At any rate, we talked about something which is called the natural length. And the way to think about that is it is the length of the string if it is not being compressed or stretched. So it would be what it would be if you just lay it down on the ground or something like that. And the degree to which the spring is conveying a force on something, or the amount of energy that the spring stores within it because it's compressed or stretched, is always calculated relative to what it would have at that natural length. So the spring itself basically can't do work that's just sitting there and unstretched, uncompressed. So it has no energy stored in it. So that would be where the potential energy is zero. And it's not exerting a force one way or the other. So everything is done with respect to this natural length, which I'm calling x0 here, if I think of this as the x-axis, and the string is just sitting there. Very often in your equations, and almost always when you're thinking about doing problems, it makes sense to just basically set x0 equal to 0 when you're thinking about what that string is doing. So when you do that, the string equation then has the force with which it is exerting. The force that the spring would exert on something if it were being compressed or stretched, sort of here, for example, if I stretch it out, the force of the spring is equal to minus k times this distance, which if you want to think about vectors and x0 is not 0, it would be x minus x0. If you take x0 as 0, then it would basically just be this distance. And when you actually want to put the direction explicitly in the equation and have it explicitly in the force, then you really have to use this vector x. with this being 0, so x greater than 0, so it would be a vector going from this point out to that point. So it has a direction. And the minus sign here then basically tells you that the force is in the opposite direction. So if I stretch it out in x, the force goes back. If I compress it in x, here, for example, x would be negative, and then the minus sign times that would give me a positive force going the other way. So the minus sign enforces the restoring force aspect of it. The k is something which specifies the nature of the spring. Not all springs are equal. Some are very light springs, easy to compress and stretch. Others are very, very stiff. And k is just a number that is unique for every spring, and it is either given to you in a problem that involves springs, or it is something you'll have to figure out from the data that you're given. So, very often, the direction is something that you just can see from the problem itself. And my advice is, most of the time, don't worry about the vector equation at all. I simply know if I have a spring here and I stretch it out this way, I know it's going back. The force is pulling me back. If I go this way, I know it's pushing me that way. So I can get the orientation of the force depending on what's going on in the problem. If you start putting the vector piece together, you're going to run into trouble. The reason you're going to run into trouble is it's very easy to sort of put a sign in. I mean, it's very easy to put this minus sign in and sort of forget to put the sign in for that vector. And if you're not thinking about it, you'll actually end up with the force going in the wrong direction. It's really easy to sort of double count that and get it wrong. So that's why, generally, my advice is don't think of it this way. Think of it this way. The direction you get from what's going on in the problem, and what you really need to know is what is the magnitude of that force. And the magnitude of the force goes as a positive k times whatever the extension or compression is in terms of length. Okay? And usually that will serve you better and give you less of a chance to screw something up if your mind is sort of worried about other aspects of the problem. Okay, any questions about that?
So it's pretty simple. But you'll note that it is complicated compared to the other system that we've really studied so far, which is gravity.
Gravity has a force which is constant in magnitude near the surface of the Earth. It's just not constant. It's mg, right? And if I drop something, that force stays mg in the region that we worry about, which is near the surface of the Earth. In another class or so, we'll analyze it. If you go far enough, the g begins to change, and we'll look at it that way. But today, we're already in that situation. Because if I take a spring and I begin to stretch it, it exerts a different force depending on where I am. Okay, the force gets larger and larger and larger. So the variation of that force sort of makes life a little more complicated. And we're going to look at that now. Because what I'd like to do is to examine what is the energy stored in the spring as I stretch it out. Okay? And a way to think about that is when we were looking at gravitation, if I take a book, for example, and I do work to lift it up, I am giving it a potential energy, which is equal to this mgh, the amount by which I lift it up. So a way to think about how the energy is stored in the book, the potential energy, is to examine what kind of work I do as I actually change that variable. That's what I want to do here. If the spring is unstretched, so let's say it has a natural length of x0, I've drawn it here, stretched. If it has a natural length x0, the spring is just like that. It has no potential energy stored in it because it's not going to be able to do work on anything. It's just sitting there. But if I now stretch it out, then you can imagine a stretch spring. If I hook something up to it, it can exert a force through a distance. So it is able to do work, which means within the spring itself, I now have energy stored. And so what I'd like to do is to look at what that energy is as I stretch it out from one position to another to see how it changes. So what I'd like to do is to basically take the spring, which is at its natural length, and begin to stretch it out. And then for generality, I just want to basically look at how the energy changes between two positions. I'm going to choose arbitrarily position X1 and X2, just so I have a problem I can work with to try to understand what happens. And in this case, I'm going to actually think about how much work I do on the spring as I grab it and stretch it out from the distance X1 out to the distance X2. And I have to be that specific because the work that I do on the spring depends on the relative direction of the force that I do on the spring and the distances that I go. So directionality is really important because, as you already saw with gravitation, if I pick a book up and I do like this, I'm doing positive work to it, and if I do this, I'm doing negative work to it. So that turns out to be pretty important when it comes to energy. So in this case, this is my general definition of the total work done, where it is basically force times distance done in such a way that it is the force along the direction that I'm moving, which is what the dot product basically gives you. And these both have direction. In this particular case, I'm asking what is the work that I do, which means the force that I'm considering here has to be the force that I am exerting. So I am exerting a force which is going this way because I'm pulling the spring out. So my force is going that way. As I push it out, the variable S basically is increasing as I go, and it is equivalent to S, right? Because in this case, the X axis curve as I've defined it along here and D and S are sort of the same thing, the same variable. So I can say that if I define this as a positive direction, for example, then this DS vector is basically also, it's a DX vector. So I'll more or less substitute that together. And then the force is that way. The S vector, or the DX, is that way because I'm moving that way. They're in the same direction. The vectors are parallel to one another. So the dot product simplifies to simply the magnitude of the force times that distance, which is DS. If you've always wondered why in the hell we ever had to do integrals, here's a perfect example of why. Okay, I can't just multiply force times distance here. Why? Because as I stretch it out, the force is changing, and it's changing continuously. What force do you use? Do I use the force that's right here? Do I use the force that's right there? Do I take some average in the middle? It doesn't really work any of those ways. If I give this problem on a test, some reasonable fraction of the class is going to choose some one of these things and just say force times distance, and they're going to choose the force at that particular point. But that doesn't work because the force is changing as I move. So the way around that is you think, well, if I think of some arbitrary place in the middle of this, and I only consider how much work I do if I move it only a teeny tiny little bit, over that teeny tiny little bit, you can consider the force as being constant. That's because it is such a small distance that you go, effectively it isn't the change in the distance. That's what we mean when we say differential. I can understand how much work I do over that differential stretch because it's such a tiny length. I'll consider the force as fixed over that length, and I can just take the force and multiply it by the distance, which is the differential ds or dx that we're using. You have to use the dot product because things are in different directions. We know in this case the dot product is very simple. But now I have to sum all these little things up, and that is what I'm doing with the integral. Okay? So that's how you sort of do these kinds of problems. So now, this is simple to evaluate. It's FDS, which is FDX. And I do this integral from x1 out to x2. So I sum all the little bits of work that I do as I go from x1 to x2. I know what f is. This is now a magnitude. And this is where you screw up if you start thinking vectors. Okay? In this case, I've already taken into account the direction. I took it into account here when I realized that my f and my s were going in the same direction. Okay, that was the directional piece. If I now put it in again by making this a minus k, I've blown the problem. Okay, you got the direction wrong. You just put it in twice. So here it's a magnitude, so that just becomes kx. I'll take x0 as 0, so this is kx. The integral of kx, the k is a constant, pulls out, and I have the integral of x dx, which is x squared over 2. I then evaluate it between the two limits, so I have x2 squared over 2 minus x1 squared over 2. I pull the 2 out, multiplied by the constant. So it's 1/2 k times the change in the distance x that you pull. And this actually is a pretty simple result. And you'll note that it only depends on the endpoints. It doesn't actually matter anything else that happened in between. I can measure how much energy is stored in the spring at point F, or what the change in the energy was between x1 and x2 by simply knowing what x1 and x2 and k are. Okay? So if I define the potential energy stored in the spring as 1/2 kx squared, then you'll see that up above, the change in the potential energy as I go from x1 to x2 is equal to the change in this quantity 1/2 kx squared, which is 1/2 kx2 squared minus 1/2 kx1 squared, which is what we found. So by examining how the energy in the system changes as I go through this motion, I basically can figure out how it is that I can define the potential energy stored in the spring such that I basically will get that answer where work is concerned. So this is a pretty important result, and it turns out to be, you know, really useful in a lot of ways. I hope that you've already seen with the problems that you've done in gravitation that very often it is certainly true that you can do the problem by using your one-dimensional kinematics equations, which you're used to doing. But when you get the hang of doing the problem involving energy, this little MGH thing that you can use, very often something that would involve a calculation with kinematics equations, you can just look at and write down the answer where energy is concerned. So time and time again in this class and in Physics 114, you will find that you may study something and then you will study how it depends on the energy, because it turns out that very often how things work with energy is a lot simpler to sort of understand. You run into that a lot. In chemistry, the way in which the force of the nucleus is acting on the electron is a very complicated sort of thing. But if you go to sort of the energy space, if you want to think of it that way, it's easy to look at differences in energy. You call them things like ionization energy. It's how much energy it takes to remove the electron from the atom. You look at spectroscopy, which is the difference in energy between two orbitals, and things like that. So in the energy world, very often, it's a lot simpler to do things. The other thing about energy is that
it has no direction. So very often energy may only depend on relative orientation of things, or not orientation, but distances. And it's a lot easier to deal with distances than it is with distances and directions. That's a lot harder. Okay, so let me do an example. Let's suppose that we have a spring. Which is hanging
from the ceiling or something like that. So here's our spring. This isn't a great spring because this I'd like it if it were natural length like that, so you could actually see that it's a spring. But there's our spring. And
we take that spring. And we attach a mass to it. In this case, I'll just do a fish. So it's like you take a fish and hang it on the spring. We're going to say that this is the natural length.
And the fish that we hang on it, try to figure a fish. Okay, so it has its natural length, the fish is not on it. Now I hang the fish on it, and what I'm doing is I let it down slowly until the fish is supported. And I let it go. And now I have this physical situation.
So you hang the fish, you let fish drop slowly until it is supported at rest. Okay? And when I do that, the spring is stretched a distance D. Then what I say is that I take the fish and I start it,
I sort of hold it up so that it is, the spring is exactly at its natural length, and then I let it go. Okay? So it starts out, I'm supporting it, the fish is at its natural length, the fish is on it, it's at its natural length because the spring isn't supporting it, and I am. And then I let it go, and it falls down to a certain point and then goes back up. Okay? And the question that I want to ask you is, how far down does the fish fall?
So here's the starting point. And then I drop it. And what I want to know is, what is this distance H? When you're at this point, V is equal to zero. That is, it's at the bottom. Okay? That's what I want to ask. That's the problem. Now bear with me just a second. My laptop is sort of old and the software is getting corrupt, I think. Because this particular program has been acting really clunky to the point where if I save the file and I close it, when I open it back up, random pages are just missing. Which means I find myself after lecture having to go back to my office and basically rewrite everything or certain pages. And then I have to remember what it was that I wrote. So if in fact you find that what I have on the web for some of these things is a little bit different from what you have in your notes, that's probably what happened. So sorry about that. But what I started to do this morning, because of the pages that I prepared, I just closed and opened it up and they had already disappeared. I started actually doing snips so I can save them in case I lose them. And unfortunately, it means I need to do that for every page right now. I may start using a different program, of course, but come on. So there's the problem. Now you'll note that it's actually sort of two problems that seem to be very different things. The one piece is I let the fish down and it hangs there, and you may wonder, well, why are you telling me that? Because the problem is I put the fish at this natural length and I let it go and I want to know how far down it goes. Okay. And you'll find in spring problems that's a very common thing. What it allows you to do is to calculate the spring constant. So the problem may give you the spring constant, in which case you commonly won't see this sort of add-on problem. But if they don't give you the spring constant, there will be part of the problem that gives you enough information to calculate the spring constant. And the spring constant, once you've determined it for that spring, that's the spring constant that's always used for that spring. So then you're good. So in this case, usually they'll give you something that allows you to sort of calculate easily the spring constant. If you look at the fish in the first part, here, it has a spring force, if we look at the free body diagram, which is up, and it has mg, which is down, and it has an acceleration, which is zero. So the sum of the forces is equal to zero, which is equal to, it's mg minus the force of the spring. I don't put in the vector because I just took into account direction with the minus sign. And this will be mg minus kx. X in this case is D. So I have that mg is equal to kd, or k is equal to mg over d. So if I give you a problem, and this problem, where you have the mass and the distance given to you, you can then calculate k. What are the units of k? K takes a force, and you multiply it. K, when you multiply it by a distance, gives you a force. So the units of K are newtons per meter. And here we have newtons, and this is a distance in meters, so it works. Okay? So now we have K in this problem, so now we can go off and solve the rest of the problem, assuming that we know K. Now, there are different ways you might do this, potentially, when you stop and think about it. Can you use your, could you, theoretically, use your one-dimensional kinematics acceleration equation, kinematics equation, like you could do with gravity? That's a little more than a rhetorical question. If I gave this problem on a test, many of you would do that. Can you do that? Does it work? How do you know? I call day. We lose the room in 35 minutes, but I'll say it. What do you think? Yes?
Acceleration is constant.
Acceleration is constant. The acceleration of gravity is constant. As it goes down, though, what happens with the spring force? The spring is constantly pulling up, and it is changing. So unlike what we sort of have done with gravity, in this case, the force is not constant. So if you, one, it means that your constant acceleration equations simply aren't valid. You still can use those general equations in principle, but now you're stuck because basically you have to do the integral to figure out what's going on. You have to do integrals to figure out what's going on. So it's a complicated problem.
But there's an easier way to do it,
which is to think about the energy of the system. You can look at the energy at the starting point and the energy at the ending point. And if I have no external force happening on this, doing something on this thing, those energies will be equal. Right?
So let's use energy conservation and see just how easy it can be. So in this case, let's try energy conservation. Into a different color because it's the next part. So up at the top, here's our fish. At the bottom, here's our fish. And so now let's look at the energy. If we let the zero for gravity be here, then I can say that E start is equal to the potential energy due to gravity plus the potential energy. Alright, sorry. I'm going to do this where I have more room. Thank you.
this is going to annoy me. Okay, a lie. It already has been annoying me. Come on. All right. So if we look at the start, here's our fish. Let me let this be the zero for the height. Zero for stretching the spring, it's also the zero for the height. In this case, I'll just define it that way. So what that means is the energy at the start is equal to the potential energy due to gravity plus the potential energy due to the spring plus any kinetic energy that I have. It is not moving. So this is zero. The potential energy due to gravity is basically mg times the height. This part I've defined as zero, so that term is zero. And the potential energy stored in the spring is also zero because it's equal to 1/2 times k times x squared,
and I have the fish explicitly starting where x is zero, that is the natural length of the spring. Okay? So the energy at the start is zero.
If we look at the situation where the fish is now at the bottom, here's the zero. This distance is what we've defined as d in the problem. Oh no, sorry. It's what we've defined as h is the problem in the problem. So the energy at the end is equal to the potential energy due to gravity plus the kinetic energy plus the potential energy due to the spring plus the kinetic energy. So again, this is zero. You say, but it is moving. Well, it's not. At the very bottom, at the very instant there, right? It's zero. And now, there's a possibility of getting screwed up with algebraic signs. So I like to think of it sort of mentally. If I lift it up, I know that I have more potential energy where the gravity is concerned. As the gravity goes down, it's basically going to lose gravitational potential energy. That gets converted into the kinetic energy of the fish moving and the energy it takes to stretch the spring. So when you look at those two things, down to the bottom, I clearly have a lot of energy in the spring because it's stretched. Where does that energy come from? It comes from the potential energy of the gravity. Okay, so you can sort of just think your way through it. That's why I'm going to say that this is minus mgh. This is equal to zero because I have energy conservation. And this is 1/2 kx squared, but in this case, x is the h squared. So what that means is that another way to think about it
is that I know that when it's at the top, it's starting with a certain amount of energy. If I think relative to the bottom, that amount of energy is mg times h. And at the bottom, the gravity is zero, so potential energy due to gravity is equal to zero. But I've stretched the spring. So I know that in terms of the energy flow, the energy starts out as mgh, and it goes to 1/2 kh squared. So that's sort of another way to think about it. In this, either way, you note that you can't really get around having to sort of think about what's happening. If you just rely on this change in potential energy plus change in kinetic energy as work non-conservative, I don't know how you get the signs in this right consistently. It sort of becomes a random, I think. Okay, so I think you really have to think your way through these problems about how the energy flows. And I just did it sort of two different ways, and in the end, both ways give you the same equation, which is that mgh is equal to 1/2 kh squared. So h is equal to 2mg over k. K is in, so mg is a force, k is newtons per meter, so that's a force divided by meter, so in terms of units, this has units of distance. So the units were. So that is basically the answer to the problem. You can substitute in what you have for k if you wish, which we discovered was mg over d. H turns out to be just 2d. Okay? You're all right with this? So let me do a different example. Let's suppose that we have a spring situated such that it's up against a block. And we have and I tell you that this is the natural length for the spring. And that this distance, which is the amount the spring is compressed, is 0.1 meters. And that K of the spring is equal to 100 newtons per meter, and that the block is equal to 0.5 kilograms. Sorry, I actually meant to make this 0.2, so it's 20 centimeters,
0.2 meters.
And then the block gets released. So we start out, I compress it, and now I just let it go. And when I do that, the block
travels. Along the floor, so the floor continues. And we'll say that this distance from here is is 1 meter. So the block travels
4. It comes to rest. I have not specified that we have no friction, so in this case, what makes it come to rest? If it were on ice, for example, there'd be no friction, it would just go on forever, right? In this case, we have friction, and the problem is, given all this information, what is mu sub k? Okay? And so now, I'd like to
step back and just think about what's happening in the problem and think about the energy flow. Note that there's no change in height in this problem, so I don't really have to worry about gravity at all. There is a normal force, there is a force of friction, so I do need to worry about that. And we have the spring involved. Okay? So
I guess I didn't really say it clearly, but let me say it now. If I were giving you this problem on a test, I would say something weird like, the block is pushed under the spring, but the block, or the block is unattached to the spring, but is pushed on the spring. Spring is compressed, but the block is not fastened to the spring. Why do I specify that? Yeah, so pretend this is sideways, okay? If it were attached to the spring, so I compress it, and now I let it go, what happens? It oscillates, okay? The spring stays attached to it, and maybe we can solve the problem, or maybe not, but it's a different problem. If I tell you that the spring, that the block is not actually attached, at what point does the spring lose contact with the block? The spring pushes the block. It's the only force in that direction. So it gives you an acceleration, 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 all the way to the point. Remember, this the force of the spring on the block. I've compressed the spring, which means the spring is pushing up against the block. It's a non-zero force. When I release it, the spring exerts a force on the block that is is kx, where x is this distance. Now the block slides all the way to this point. Until the spring reaches that point, there is a positive force on that block pushing it towards the center. Right? So the block goes faster and faster. At the very instant that the spring reaches that link, what happens? The spring may continue forward, but now there's an acceleration on the spring. The mass of the string, we actually deal with massless strings, so this isn't quite kosher, but as it goes past that equilibrium point, the force of the spring is now this way, it's going backwards, but it's not attached to the block.
So a way to think about it is, if this is the spring and this is the block, the spring, as I compress the spring, there's a force this way. So I have a force like this pushing it. It goes and it goes and it goes until it hits the equilibrium point. Now this force is sort of like that, which means the spring is accelerating backwards. Right? It may still be going forward, but it's now got a force on it backwards. This block, now it loses contact with the spring and it just continues forward. Okay? So, if there's some wording that says something like the block is unattached to the spring, what it's telling you is you know how long the spring is in contact with that block. Why do I care? You know, I said, why do I care? I didn't say, why do you care? But if you were taking on a test, you would not care. I compress the spring, I give it energy. Okay? Where does that energy go as it's pushing the block? Sorry? So as I compress the spring here, I have energy stored in the spring. I now release it. Where does the energy go? The energy will go two places. It will go into the kinetic energy of this block, and it will go to friction. Let me not worry about friction for a moment. What would the kinetic energy of this block be at the point that it passes here if I had no friction in the problem at all? In that case, I take all the energy in the spring. At the moment the spring is here, it has zero potential energy left. All that energy is converted into the energy of motion of this block. So you get 1/2 mv squared is equal to 1/2 kx squared. So that would be how the energy would flow. So then you have the block that in principle you know what its velocity is, except for the fact it's also losing energy due to friction. Okay? So that's the kind of thinking you have to do. If the problem were constructed that you needed to know the velocity of the block initially, then you could set 1/2 mv squared equals 1/2 kx squared, because that's how the energy flows. This is actually a different problem in the sense that we have friction all along the surface, and I know that I go 1 meter, and it's beyond the point where it is, so we want to know what happens. So the way to think about it is the energy at the start, all of the energy is the potential energy in the spring, which is 1/2 times K. I'm going to call this D. 1/2 K D squared, because I don't want to put the number in yet. So that's the energy you start with. And then as the block goes, so as the block goes some distance x beyond the 0.2 meter compression here, the energy goes from the spring to, do I want to do an intermediate step right now? No, sorry, we could, but I think it'd be confusing, so let me not. At the end, what is the energy? If the block stops, it has no kinetic energy. The spring, in fact, in the problem, you think of it as pushing until it reaches its equilibrium point and then basically stopping. In reality, there would be some inertia and it would sort of oscillate a little, but we're going to ignore that. So there's no energy stored in the spring at that point. It's getting all of its potential energy over to the block. So the energy had to all go to friction. So E lost to friction
must equal to the normal force, which is mg. Because acceleration is zero up and down, times mu sub k, times the distance that it goes, which is this 1 meter. So I can set 1/2 k d squared is equal to mg mu sub k times the distance that it goes. And in this problem, we said this was one meter. We said this was 100 g, you know, this is 0.5 kilograms, and d itself is 0.2 meters. No, yes, no. Sorry. This is what you want to calculate, and this is 100.
So you have everything but mu sub k, so you can calculate mu sub k. Okay with that? Yes.
Don't you also have friction when the spring is still acting on the block, so would there be some energy lost while the spring is still acting on it?
Yes, there is, and in fact, the total distance it goes is the 1 meter, so I have that distance included. That includes this 20 centimeters while
it's moving. Okay, I see that. Thank you.
Okay. So we assume all the energy was transferred to the block because we assume the spring was massless?
We assume all the energy is transferred to the block and we assume the spring is massless, yes.
Will we ever have a situation where the spring has mass?
So the question is, will you ever have a situation where the spring has mass? And it would be very unlikely that I would do that to you. I'd have to be in an extraordinarily perverse mood to do that to you. Okay?
This is going to be annoying.
So I want to step away from springs a little bit right now and give you a bit more information about energy type stuff. So very often, one of the things that's very important isn't just how much energy you have, but the rate at which it happens. Right, so if you're looking for some excitement and you're going car shopping or whatever, right, you look for horsepower. And what that really quantifies is how much energy per unit time the engine can produce. Because basically the more horsepower you have, the faster you can accelerate. That's really what it boils down to. Horsepower is an English unit of energy per unit time. We
use a different unit in MKS, but what we find is it's really important very often in thinking about energy to think about power. And we'll define that as the change in work per unit time. The rate of energy flow, if you want. Okay. And you can have instantaneous. You can have an average power where you have the finite, the endpoints for a time interval. Or you can have instantaneous power, but the power instantaneously is the dW over dt. And the units of work is a joule. That's the unit of energy in MKS. I guess we haven't used that yet, but per second. And just for job security, you have to take any combination of unit things and turn them into something else so nobody knows what you're talking about. But we call this the watt. And in fact, that you may be used to, because a 100-watt light bulb is a light bulb which burns 100 joules of energy per second. That's the definition of it.
It's relatively easy to think about energy flow or energy in a system. And in some ways, it's a lot easier than it is to actually fully understand the force. So, for example, if you're dealing with chemistry, it's relatively easy to determine what the energy is between two orbitals or something by looking at the transition energy to go from one point to another, which you can establish by how much light energy absorbs to make the transition or whatever. But to try to understand the actual force in there, it's sort of a more complicated thing. So in many instances, it's easier to visualize and think about how energy changes from one point to another than it is to really understand the force. And it turns out there's a very nice connection between energy and the force. So we've defined work, or if you want to think of it, the energy, the work done on a system as the force times the distance through which you go. If you want to, I sort of want to do a bit of a hand-waving argument to justify something that we want to get to. So if I move at a small distance, dW is, say, equal to the force times the distance dx that I go. You've seen examples where we use this already. If I want to think about it, this change in work that I do, I can think of as a change in the potential energy. And it's conventional when you start talking about a function that describes how the energy is at different points, you call it a potential energy function, and it's usually we use a symbol U. So if I do work to a system, in a sense, I'm also changing its internal energy or its potential energy. So I'll call that dU is equal to F times dx. So that means that the change in the energy with respect to position, if I'm moving it a little bit, is proportional to the force along that direction. So let's take an example. For a spring, we know that the potential energy, which we've now calculated,
goes as 1 half k times x squared. So let us look at how the potential energy changes as a function of x. This is x, which, remember, is whether you're stretched or compressed with respect to the center, so it makes sense to call that 0. Let me plot the potential energy function, how much energy is stored in the spring as a function of where you are. If the spring is 0, if it has no compression, no extension, it's right here. And then this function goes as a quadratic, 1 half kx squared. So it's going to look like a parabola. Not very well drawn one, but that's... Okay? Now notice that the derivative of the potential energy function with respect to x is equal to kx,
which, remember, is the magnitude of the spring force. This derivative is positive over here, and it tells me that the magnitude of the force is kx, which I happen to get from the derivative. Note that if I gave it a minus sign, it would actually give me the force, the vector force. If I put a minus sign right here and it made it a vector, the derivative of this function would be equal to minus the actual force. Or in other words, yeah, so if minus and vector, you know, it's a vector thing, then I get the force. So this is actually a general... So I'm sort of a little bit hand-waving because I just want it to sort of make sense to you what I'm about to write. Which is the force in some given direction, which I'll call S, is equal to minus the derivative of the energy function with respect to S. And that's the relationship between the potential energy function and force. If I take a spring and I'm only worrying about things along the x direction, then S is x. Okay? I say that the force of the spring, the force along the x direction, is equal minus the derivative of the function 1 half kx squared divided with respect to x. Okay? If I have some other system, whatever its coordinate is, you would use it. So you can imagine having a system which you will run into in electromagnetism where you might have an energy that changes as a function of where you are in three dimensions, okay? Which is why I specified this way. In which case you can ask, what is the force in the x direction, y direction, z direction? And in that case, you would say the force in the x direction is minus the derivative of that function with respect to x. The force in the y direction is minus the derivative of the function with respect to y. The force in the z direction is minus the derivative of the function with respect to z. And if you use partial derivatives, we did a little bit in lab, you would realize that because you're a function of x, y, and z, this actually would have to be partial derivative. I will not give you anything that is in multiple dimensions. If I ask you to do anything with energy and forces like this, I'll give it to you in one dimension. So whatever that dimension is, that's the one that you use to take the derivative of.